Monroe County Tourist Development Council. 13 museums and attractions from Key Largo to Key West offer special entry to WLRN listeners who present the admissions flyer. A list of participating venues and attractions can be found at WLRN.org. Click on the Florida Keys and Key West Museum weekend banner and print the weekend pass.
Support for NPR newscasts come from the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs and their innovations to solve the world's most pressing problems at skoll.org.
And we're back on this Thursday afternoon. Joseph Cooper with you. It's today's Topical Currents. Well, this afternoon we begin with practicing therapist and relationship expert, Dr. Terry Orbach. We'll discuss her book, Finding Love Again, Six Simple Steps to a New and Happy Relationship. It's based on a 25-year study of 373 heterosexual couples. Dr. Terry Orbach is a research professor at the University of Michigan, and she joins us from Pontiac. Welcome to you, Dr. Terry Orbach.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
Well, you're known as the love doctor. Mm-hmm. What's most important for a successful rebound?
Well, I think, first I should say, Joseph, that I've been following the same 373 couples now for over 25 years. It's a long-term study on marriage, divorce, and new love funded by the National Institutes of Health. 46% of those married couples have divorced over time. And one of the most important things for finding new love again, adjusting and coping constructively or effectively, is having a positive attitude, being optimistic about your future, and that you will find a new relationship in the future. So those individuals or divorced singles who are able to say, I am hopeful, I will be able to rebound, I will be able to find new love again, were in fact significantly more likely to find new love.
It's kind of difficult, though, after going through a divorce or a big-time breakup, to stay positive and be bright-eyed and bushy-tailed.
Absolutely. And many of the individuals said, you know, how do I move on? Am I too old to start over? How do I trust someone? And many people even asked, is it worth the effort if I do try or find someone again? First, it is worth the effort. And so people who do find new love are significantly healthier, both physically and psychologically. So it is worth the effort. And there are several steps that we found are really important to then remain optimistic and hopeful. The first step is to examine your expectations and your beliefs about relationships. Many of the divorced singles in our study had common sense notions or beliefs or unrealistic ideas about relationships, divorce, and love. For example, many people felt that there's a definite period that they had to wait after a divorce or a breakup before they get back out there and date again. But what we know and what we found in this study is that there's no research to support that you need to wait any set time period before you are ready or before you even get back out in the dating world. Everybody copes, adjusts, grieves differently. Some people are ready to date again when they're still in the relationship, and other people need to physically separate before they can date again. So the first step, Joseph, is really to make sure that you have realistic expectations. And when you do, you're going to become less frustrated and you will be more optimistic.
What about the time period, say, perhaps if you've become single because of death, if you were a widower or a widow?
I think it's the same situation. Some people, given certain circumstances, perhaps a spouse was very ill, either psychologically or physically, for a long period of time. And so they've done a lot of the grieving and thinking and processing so that when their spouse does pass away, they are more ready for a new relationship than someone who the circumstances were completely different and it was immediate, or they didn't have the same kind of time period to grieve and mourn. I think the important thing to remember, at least from this study and the findings from this long-term study, is that everyone is different. There's no rule for anyone in terms of a set period of time, whether you're grieving because of a divorce or a breakup or your spouse or partner passing away.
If you've had a breakup, there probably has been a lot of conflict to precede that. When you go on the rebound, should you look for someone who doesn't rock the boat, someone that just kind of get along with?
That's a good question. I think conflict is inevitable in all romantic relationships. So, you know, there were four couples in study in year one in my long-term study, married couples who said, we never fight, we never have any disagreements. None of those four couples were still together in year three. And so what we have found tracking these couples is that, again, conflict is inevitable. You're bound to disagree and have arguments, and because when you think about it, you're from different families, neighborhoods, backgrounds. You're not going to agree on everything. It's how you handle the conflict that's so very important. So if I were to give a recommendation, I would say that you want to find someone, not that doesn't rock the boat, not that you don't disagree with, but that can handle conflict constructively. One of the questions, once you do find someone and you think it's serious, is you want to ask yourself, how do we do conflict? Because if you don't do conflict well, you don't fight fair, you are not able to have a stable relationship over the long haul. So ask yourself, does this person fight well with me? Do we have conflict in a constructive way? Do we listen to one another? Are we calm? Do we not name, call, scream, or leave the room? Those are things that are very important to ask yourself.
Our telephone number, if you'd like to join in with relationship expert Dr. Terry Orbuch, our number 1-800-743-WLRN, 1-800-743-9576, or email, that's radio at WLRN.org. Tell me, Dr. Orbuch, are some people just better off alone and they do themselves a favor and maybe a potential partner a favor by staying alone?
Well, I think you can be lonely if you're alone or in a relationship. So what you really want to ask yourself is, you know, do I want someone in my life to share the goods and the bads with me? One of the interesting things that we found is that having a romantic relationship helps you in times of trouble, but it also helps you in times of good things as well. You have somebody to celebrate with. You have somebody to, you know, if you get an award or you get a raise or you get a new job, you have someone to go home to or share that experience with. We definitely have found that having a romantic relationship is not enough. You need to be in a happy and healthy romantic relationship. And if you're in a healthy, happy romantic relationship, you're less likely to be anxious and depressed. You're even less likely to get the flu or colds because it boosts your immune system. You're also more likely to be happier and to feel more optimistic and hopeful about your life in general. So I think what you want is not to ask yourself, do I need a romantic relationship, but I want a romantic relationship that's happy and healthy over time.
I was reading in the book that you say that the sense of smell is so important as far as picking a mate or a partner, and that you should maybe sneak in and take a whiff of someone's closet and see whether you're turned on or off.
Yeah, you know, know, it's so interesting.
The pheromones, I guess.
Exactly. And women, this is much more important for women than it is for men, Joseph, that a sense of smell actually increases attraction and increases sexual desire for a partner. And so there are some smells that, so to speak, turn us off or are unpleasant, either because of childhood memories or we've grown to not like certain smells. So yes, be sure to remember that smell is important as you're picking a mate or a long-term partner, and that listen to that sense of smell. And yeah, you know, smell their clothing or smell them and see how you feel afterwards, because that smell obviously isn't going to go away. And it is part of the pheromones of that individual, of this partner, and the attraction over time.
Now, Dr. Terry Orbuch, of these 373 couples that you've studied for some 25 years, you mentioned earlier that 46% have been divorced. I guess that's pretty close to the national average of, what, 50%. But tell me, why is it that second marriages tend to fail even more frequently than first?
Well, first I should say, Joseph, that of the 46% that divorced, 71% actually found new love again. And so that's an optimistic percentage. But one of the things that happens when you do repartner or remarry is that you oftentimes pick the same kind of mate or partner that you were attracted to the first time. And so the same kinds of patterns, the same dysfunctional patterns continue in that second or third relationship or marriage as were present in the first. So one of the things that's so very important then for individuals who do get divorced or experience a long-term breakup is to really step back and make sure that you're not strongly connected emotionally to your previous relationship and to the past. So we all have emotional baggage, but you want to make sure that that baggage isn't too heavy. It's not too negatively heavy or positively heavy. So you're not still angry or you're not still pining away or longing for that person. And so one of the things that was so essential is that if you can say to yourself, I don't feel much of anything toward my ex, that's when you are more likely then to pick someone who is not the same kind of person. Second thing that was important for these new partnerships and staying together in a new partnership is to really be able to know yourself. Many of us compromise and we become people or we have values that really aren't us. And so that when we divorce, we don't really know who we are. So one of the things that was so important for divorced singles in this study is to say, what are my key life values? How do I describe myself? What is truly me, the real me? And when you can do that, then when you get back out in the dating world, you're less likely to pick someone the same from your first marriage, and you're much more likely to pick someone who has similar underlying values and attitudes, which is significantly important for the stability of that new relationship.
Let's take a call or two, Dr. Terry Orbuch. I've got first caller, West Palm Beach. This is Joe. Hello, Joe.
Yeah, I had a quick question about honesty. If you meet somebody and you know that you're not going to be marrying them because of one reason or another, but you enjoy their company, is it dishonest not to tell them that this relationship is not going where you think it might be going?
Well, Joe, I think that's a really great question. I think, at least from the couples in my study, honesty was really important. Whether you were planning on getting remarried or not, telling this partner after a certain period of time that here's where I expect the relationship to go what are your expectations? Because otherwise, down the road, if their expectations are different than yours and you haven't been honest, they're going to become extremely frustrated and extremely angry at you. And so to prevent that, to avoid that, I think it's important to be honest from the start.
But at what time do you tell them, I wonder, that you're not sure that, you know, and is it dangerous to be in that relationship if you don't have plans for the future, I wonder?
Well, I think it's important to tell that partner when you know for sure that the relationship is not going toward marriage and it is going toward a different kind or type of relationship, whether that be a long-term commitment or whether that be a companion or whether that be something else. When you are sure about what your expectations are, then it's important to discuss those expectations with that partner. Now, is it dangerous to be in that kind of relationship? If both of you are on the same or at the same point, if both of you have the same expectations and you know for sure that that person is being honest with you with her or his expectations, then it's okay. Then you're agreeing that the relationship is a different kind than others may be expecting of you or a marital relationship.
And let's see, I have an emailer here. This is Alyssa in Hollywood. How does exploring a new relationship change when a young child has been through a divorce too? What are the parents' responsibilities to the child when seeking a new partner?
Well, I think any time a child goes through a transition like divorce, it's very important for the parents, if I understand the question correctly, it's very important for the parents to support the child, to not judge the decision of the child. It's so important. And the divorced singles in my study said that having the family there and friends there to support them through this period of time was so important to their health and well-being going through the transition. And oftentimes, we really need someone just to listen. Many times when a divorced single tells others, like parents or other family members, the story of their relationship, it's important for those others to listen and be there for them. So I think support is essential if we're talking about the parents and a child getting divorced.
We're speaking with Dr. Terry Orbuck. We're talking about her book, Finding Love Again, Six Simple Steps to a New and Happy Relationship. Doctor, how about a website where people can learn more about you and the book?
My website is Dr. Terry, DrTerri, thelovedoctor.com. That's all one word, Dr. Terry, thelovedoctor.com.
Okay. And we'll move along to a Miami caller. This is Anna. Hello, Anna. How are you?
Hi. I am a third-year law student. I'm in a successful long-distance relationship, but I've noticed that at least in the legal profession, there seem to be some idiosyncrasies that play into the success of marriages and the divorce rate. And our divorce rate, last I checked, was about 80% in the legal profession. And I was wondering if you saw in your study what factors age and profession played into the divorce.
Well, it's a good question. You know, age of marriage did play a significant role in terms of the divorce rate in my study. And the younger one is when you get married, the more likely you are or the higher risk of divorce over time. And the breaking point, so to speak, in the study was before 25 and after 25 years old. So individuals who were married after 25 were less likely to divorce over time. We did not find that profession or occupation was important, Anna. But what we did find is that the education level of the woman was important. And we actually found something opposite to your expectation, and that was the more education a woman has, the less likely that couple is to divorce over time, which is extremely interesting and opposite to what other studies have been finding. One of the things, though, that couples said is that it's important to be on the same wavelength, so to speak, in terms of both members of the couple either being still in school or both not being in school. That one of the things that presented a challenge to many of the couples in the study was if one member was still in school and the other was not.
And was there anything on salary levels, like salary discrepancies, whether it be male or female?
You know, income level itself, as well as discrepancies or differences in income level, did not play a role in the risk of divorce over time.
Hmm.
But what did, which is very interesting, I agree, but what did is what we're calling financial strain. And financial strain was felt at all levels of income. So when you have the expectation that you should be making more and you're not, or your needs and wants and purchases, so to speak, are more than what you are bringing in income-wise, which is financial strain and stress, that was when that played a role. So the larger the strain, the larger the stress financially, the more risk of divorce over time.
And tell me, Dr. Terry Orbuch, you talk about the changes that get results. One of them includes working less if you want to engage a new relationship. Why is that?
Well, one of the things we found, which was interesting, is that those divorced singles who made one behavioral change after the divorce, and a simple behavioral change like working 1 hour less or going to the gym 1 hour more a week or taking your lunch outside in a park or a restaurant rather than at your desk. When you can make one behavioral change, it takes you out of your familiar situation, surrounding. It shakes you up, so to speak, Joseph. And what we found is that divorced individuals who are able to shake themselves up a little bit and not be in that rut, not be in a familiar surrounding and do something out of the ordinary, actually were more likely to find new people, were more likely to discover new interests, to become more excited and optimistic and hopeful about their lives, and thus were more likely to find new love again over time.
So just stir things up a little bit.
Exactly.
Let's see, take another caller. We're very short on time, but let's go to Marilyn. She's in Coconut Grove. Hello, Marilyn.
Hi, I'm calling with what some people might think are a few humorous aspects to the spouse of someone who has essentially abandoned them. One is that I think that when you formally agree to death do us part, the only actual solution would be a duel. After that, my mother-in-law actually said, after he had disappeared for several days, I would be better off if he were dead for the following three reasons. One, I would no longer have to see him. Two, no one would ever blame me or suspect that I had failed him in some way. Three, people would bring casseroles and sympathy and cards and never blame you for whatever and treat you as though you had the perfectly happiest marriage ever. And finally, you get all the money, not just...
Well, Marilyn, that's a very interesting perspective. Thanks for calling. Do you have any comment, Dr. Orbuch? Should we maintain a sense of humor?
I think maintaining a sense of
humor... That's a little bit macabre, but...
Yeah, right, exactly. Is wonderful. And not in those particular ways that Marilyn was talking about, perhaps, but it is important to recast the past in a much more positive way. So I think, you know, if you remain negative and angry, you are not able to move forward either as an individual or find new love. So if you can flip the switch, so to speak, from the negative to the neutral or the negative to the positive in thoughts and perceptions, you're much more likely to find new love and be psychologically and physically healthier over time.
Tell me more, Dr. Terry Orbuch, about this NIH-sponsored study that you've been going over 25 years. How are these couples recruited, and what about age and ethnicity and that?
Well, all of the couples got married in 1986, so everyone is experiencing the same kinds of transitions, at least early in marriage, as the other, all couples are experiencing the same kinds of transition. We got the couples through marriage licenses in a Midwestern county of the United States. And so half are Black American and half are White American. Because one of the things we were really interested in examining are the differences in race and gender in terms of relationship questions, in terms of the factors that are important to happiness, as well as the factors that are important to divorce. We continue to follow everyone, and so it's a very interesting study, even if individuals get divorced. Well, we follow the two divorced individuals.
Dr. Terry Orbach, we certainly want to thank you for joining us today. She's the author of Finding Love. Again, thank you, Dr. Terry.
Thanks for having me.
Food and Dining up next.
We'd like to thank our corporate underwriters, Kids in Distress, the law firm of Parrots, Chesil & Herman, and Saglo Development Corporation. These corporate underwriters help bring you the programs you enjoy throughout the year. Please join WLRN in thanking them for their continued support.
Jazz Roots celebrates 5 years at the Adrian Arsht Center. From unforgettable classics to jazz funk, this season highlights some of the greatest moments in America's original music genre. Grammy winners Chick Corea, George Benson, Paquito de Rivera, Dave Grusin, and Bobby McFerrin will be your guides on this season's musical journey. 6 Friday nights of Jazz Roots in the Knight Concert Hall. Subscription details at arshcenter.org.
We're funded by listeners like you and by Dry Concepts, keeping water-damaged homes out of the mold zone this hurricane season by getting them dry within 24 to 72 hours. Details at 954-370-7778 or online at dryconcepts.com.
And we're back, Joseph Cooper with today's Topical Currents. Well, our Food and Dining Thursday has finally arrived. I'm joined by colleague, chef, author, syndicated columnist Linda Gassenheimer, also known as the Lunch Goddess. Linda, one of the most fascinating and popular figures in the food world, is here in the studio, and I'm interested in learning more about him.
It really is. You know, Joe, against all odds, how does a little 3-year-old boy survive a deadly disease in his native Ethiopia to become one of America's top chefs? Well, our guest is Chef Marcus Samuelson. He did just that, and he's written a book all about it called Yes, Chef, A Memoir, describing this extraordinary journey. Mm-hmm. He's here to tell us about it. Welcome, Chef Marcus Samuelson.
Thank you so much for having me.
Great to have you with us.
I have to say, that's the best introduction song I've ever heard on the radio. That has to be from Miami.
It has a little bit of Miami.
A little bit Cubano, right?
Yes.
Oh,
sure.
I loved it. Anyway.
Well, you're making Joe very happy.
Composed
Joe's
by Michael Levine.
Oh, nice. Nice.
Local composer.
Great.
All right. Also joining us is our favorite wine guy, Fred Tasker. He's joining us by Skype. Fred, what are we drinking today?
Well, I'd like to ask Chef Marcus about wine with African recipes. That sounds pretty challenging.
All right.
Well, I mean, it's not. I mean, South Africa has produced wine for a long time. We've also
have
wines, a lot of wines from Morocco. So I think Syrah is obviously, if you think red, Syrah always works well with spices. But then you have wonderful Chenin Blanc from South Africa, of course.
Well, let's start with Marcus telling us about this. His life is fascinating. First of all, congratulations, because I understand that Yes, Chef reached number 7 on the New York Times bestseller list in his very first week.
It did, absolutely, and it's still there. Number 10, it's at number 10 right now. So.
Oh, well.
That's great.
Fantastic.
I'll have to bring it up on my Kindle, I guess.
Yeah.
All right. More accolades. You're the youngest chef to have received a three-star review from the New York Times. Mm-hmm. You've written several cookbooks and have your own TV show. So mm-hmm. you've done amazing things. Well, first let's talk about Yes, Chef. Why that title?
Well, Yes, Chef is sort of what I, as a chef, first of all, that's what I had to tell my chef for so many years, right? There's no question. It's just Yes, Chef. And then...
When you're in a kitchen?
When you're in a kitchen. Right. When you're in a kitchen, it's always Yes, Chef, or We Chef, or Yes, Chef. And so I also want to honor that title. And then eventually it became that young cooks were saying Yes, Chef to me. And that's not just what they called me, but it's also the responsibilities when you're owned up to Yes, Chef. So there's something more to that than just being called chef. There's when somebody calls you chef, that means that you're guiding that young woman or that young man and mentor them. I've been the mentee, I'm the mentor, and that's what Yes, Chef is. It's also a funny story to it is when I had the chance to cook the steak dinner for President Obama, when one of my younger chefs, Michael, got the chance to meet the president. He got so nervous, so he just yelled out, "Yes, Chef!" And everybody, even like Secret Service, were laughing. So I knew then that's the title.
That's the title. Well,
are you easy to work for?
Easy.
Or are you very temperamental?
No, not necessarily temperamental, but easy cooking, fine dining cooking, has nothing to do with easy. It's very complex, but it's also wonderful, yum, and delicious. But I think people learn a lot when they work with me. They learn a lot. And I learn a lot from them.
All right. So you have a lot of people saying Yes, Chef, to you.
Absolutely.
Okay. Well, you know, I was riveted by your story, starting with the very first chapter. Explain how you came from Ethiopia to Sweden.
Well, my sister and my mother and I, we had tuberculosis. I was born in a tiny village, but it's a two-hour drive outside Addis Ababa, the capital in Ethiopia. But back then, we walked. My mother took us on a walk from the village, Abragodana, to Addis Ababa to find a hospital that would cure us for TB. She found the hospital.
She was walking with you as a three-year-old and your sister a little older.
Yeah.
In the hot sun.
Yeah.
With tuberculosis,
with TB.
All three of you. Yeah.
And that trip, that journey, the 75 miles, really was the last thing that she did. Cause she
How many miles?
75 miles.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So it took days, and then she passed away. We got cured from TB, but, you know, what is a five-year-old and a three-year-old, where are they going to go? So it was a nurse in the hospital that took care of us, and then eventually she set us up for adoption in a Swedish, we got to Gothenburg, in a Swedish town called Gothenburg.
And the Swedish family, then you grew up there?
Yeah, I grew up in Sweden, and I have a Swedish mother and father.
Amazing story. But how did you get this passion for cooking?
Well, I love my mother, and she did a lot of things for me, but she was not a good cook. She would not even argue that. But her mother was an amazing chef, amazing cook. My grandmother, Helga, she taught me and my sisters how to make gingerbread, how to pickle herring, when to pull up the carrots, how to preserve the apples.
No Swedish meatballs, though.
Tons of Swedish meatballs and gravlax. And it was not just the recipe she taught us. She also taught us about history and the love for cooking and food. And so she was first and foremost my first teacher.
And what did you cook at her side?
We cooked roasted chicken, and then the next day chicken soup, and the third day chicken dumplings. We made a bread, and then the next day breadcrumbs that we used for the meatballs, for example.
A wonderful, wonderful background there. You speak English so well. But did you learn English there? Or?
Well, I learned English in school, but, you know, when you come from a small country like Sweden, you learn English, you taught English early on in school, and eventually I had to go abroad. Like, you know, the journey of a chef is you have to travel, you have to get out, you have to see different cultures.
So you had your culinary education, though, in Sweden. And then where did you go?
Then I got a scholarship to go to Switzerland, mm-hmm. and then eventually to France. Eventually, I got to the three-star Michelin restaurant of Georges Blanc, which my most successful year was when I got the license to work for free for a whole year.
Wow.
Yes, chef.
And Georges Blanc, that's a famous, wonderful, wonderful restaurant.
Three macarons.
Yeah. So you worked in all these countries. How did you come to the States?
I always felt that my ambitions, you know, in these places, I was the only black cook. Mm-hmm. And my ambitions of being a chef not just a regular laborer. I felt, you know what, I have to be in a country, in a city that would be open to that. And I felt like I had to move to New York. So I wrote three letters. I wrote to...
You felt New York was more open to having black chefs?
Yeah.
So did you have trouble in kitchens in Europe?
No troubles. I mean, I'm sure that, you know, kitchens are not the most friendliest place sometimes. But it was more about the ambition of being a chef. You know, Europe a very open-minded place, but not necessarily from there's not that many black-owned or other-owned restaurants, you know, in that sense, you know. But I did feel like the diversity conversation has come much further in America, specifically New York. So I really tried to go to New York. So I wrote to David Letterman and I wrote to Oprah and didn't get any reply. But
you wrote to Oprah.
Yeah, because those were the Americans that I knew. But I eventually got in at the Swedish restaurant called Aquavit in New York.
A very, very well-known restaurant.
And that became my home for 15 years.
Oh, was it for that long?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
He doesn't look that old.
I know, he looks like he's 10.
Yeah, I started early.
So tell me then... you opened Red Rooster in Harlem, and you made Harlem a hotspot for foodies. A quote from your book from President Clinton, who also has an office up there, says that you reinvigorated and reimagined what it means to be an American. That's a wonderful quote.
Well, I just felt New York is a great city, and people come from all over the world to take inspirations. But yet, the mystique around Harlem and what Harlem is today was two different things. And I said, what better than to open a restaurant there so people can come up and participate in Harlem the way that we do in a regular neighborhood. When you eat in a restaurant, you see people from that community, and Red Rooster is just that. You have visitors, you have New Yorkers, and you have the Harlemite. I'm half a block down from legendary Sylvia Woods' restaurant. She just passed away last week.
Oh, my.
But I am on 126 and Lenox Avenue, and she's on 127th and Lenox. I have a good older cousin right next to me.
Well, that was a historical place.
Absolutely. Yes, she's been in business for 50 years.
But the Red Rooster is also...
Red Rooster was definitely a restaurant. It was a bar in the sort of the first Renaissance, in the heyday of the 40s and the 50s and 60s. It was a bar on 138th Street and 7th Avenue where the writers, where the musicians and the local people went. And I thought about it. I said, wow, well, I know the writers, musicians and the politicians and the local people. Why not open a restaurant that is inspired by that?
Okay. So and
sounds like a very hip place.
It's fun. It's a mixed, you know, it's a celebration of Harlem. It's mixed people, you know, from all over the world are coming now and the locals. And that's what I love. Mm-hmm.
You seem to have a lot of African dishes that you have in your restaurant and on your website. Where did you learn about African food?
Well, I talk about it, yes, chef. You know, I didn't know about African food until I was an adult. And I learned it about 12, 13 years ago. And I just felt like being a chef is really about getting to know yourself. And being the fact that I have African background, Swedish background, and now American background, I felt like in Red Rooster, I have to celebrate all three. So part of the menu is American comfort food. Part of it is the sort of the Swedish immigrant with gravlax and meatballs. And then part of it has these African spices. And I just felt like it's all celebrated in comfort food. But it was important for me to show that narrative that Africa can actually cook modern food as well.
Well, we'll take a short break here. I'm Linda Gassenheimer, and we're talking with celebrity chef Marcus Samuelson. We'll take a short break, and we'll be back with more.
Special thank you to our Circle of Friends donor, Dr. Inez Andreas. Thank you for your generosity to WLRN.
We're funded by listeners like you and by Key West Brewfest, August 30th to September 3rd. A tasting event will be held on Saturday, September 1st from 4 p.m. to 8 p.m. with VIP entrance beginning at 3 p.m. There will be beer dinners, seminars, pool parties, and beer brunches. Details at KeyWestBrewFest.com.
And we're back. back. I'm Linda Gassenheimer, and we're talking with celebrity chef Marcus Samuelson. He's written a book called Yes, Chef. Yes, Chef, a memoir.
Yes.
Yes.
We Chef, Yes, Chef. That's in the kitchen. That is sort of the command. That's what you say whether you made mistakes, whether the chef is actually saying, hey, you did a good job. All you say back is, yes, chef.
Yes, sahib.
Yes, chef. Well, it describes his extraordinary journey from an orphaned three-year-old in Ethiopia to becoming a world-famous three-star chef in New York City. But right now, we're just going to go to dinner in minutes for those nights that you're going to be at home and not going out to a restaurant. And today's dinner is curry-kissed chicken with carrots and rice. Now, this has a dusting of curry powder flavors this very simple dish.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Not too spicy hot for you?
It could be a little hotter for me, but...
Always.
I'm always that way.
Right.
How about you, Linda?
Well, listen to what I did with it. There's no slicing or dicing for this dinner. For the side dish, you can just buy some ready-to-eat shredded carrots, and you add that to the rice after the rice is cooked, but it's still hot, so the carrots keep their crunchiness, the crisp texture. And then I took chicken tenders, which you can buy in the supermarket, and I just dusted them with a little curry powder. I sauteed them in the skillet. I took them out of the skillet, and I added some apricot jam and some cream. So that sort of takes a little bit of the heat away. It's a very colorful dish when it's served with the rice and carrots. And you can find the complete recipe at dinnerinminutes.com. Also, you can follow me on Twitter at L. Gassenheimer. I don't know, Fred, are you on Twitter still?
Oh, from time to time at Fred Tasker Miami.
Okay, so Fred, what are we drinking?
Well, you know, Marcus Samuelson appears to be a Renaissance man because he cooks American food, and he cooks can be anything, and he cooks Swedish food where I think spices are illegal. And then he cooks African food where spices appear to be required.
Yeah.
So this must lead to some challenging wine food pairings.
Aquavit is the answer to that. Vodka is the answer to that.
Oh, I see. That would work, yeah. But I was looking on the website, and for example, what wine would go best with your African-influenced paprika roasted leg of lamb, which is rubbed with spicy paprika, spicier ancho chili, and exotic cardamom.
Yeah.
And ends up with flavors that are compared to the so-called fiery Mozambique condiment called piri piri.
Mm-hmm.
What wine could possibly go with that?
Well, there's two things there. Beer would work absolutely incredible, right? That's really, I think, the beverage of choice when it's hot, and especially summertime. And a michelada would work fantastic.
What is that?
Well, sort of like a Mexican, you know, the spiced. You have a little bit of tequila, beer. You can have a little bit of spices like chilies and stuff like that you put in ice.
So it's a drink juice that's mixed with beer and...
Lime juice, beer, and then you could...
Spices.
You could put a shot of tequila in if you wanted, but that...
Sounds like a beer margarita.
Yes. But then also, I think Syrah works absolutely fantastic with this. A Pinot and a Syrah would work with the lamb, absolutely. And, you know, in South Africa, there's a wonderful blend called Pinotage. And that would
I've
work...
Yeah, I've had that, yeah.
Yeah, Pinotage would work absolutely fantastic with the lamb.
Now, I gather that you are quite high on Shiraz. I saw an article about a South African wine tasting at Red Rooster, and you had kind words both for South African Shiraz and another wine that's now just arriving in the States, which is sparkling Shiraz.
Mm-hmm. Just coming.
A sparkling Shiraz?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And South Africa is such a wonderful sort of place for where spices, food, and wine meet. Because South Africa, you have Chinese, you have Black South Africa, you have Germany and Holland and sort of the British, but you also have the Malay food. And the Malay food really, that's Indonesian inspired. And you have all these cuisines in South Africa. So where the winemakers have been always up to this challenge, what do we pair with that? So you have a bunch of wines in South Africa that matches with spices really well.
Yeah, that's a great thing to have. And one other thing that I found on the website about you, and this may not be too appropriate in this kind of hot weather, but I urge listeners to Google Marcus Samuelson and the words warm spiced wine.
Mm-hmm.
He makes red wine, and he says the cheaper the better,
yeah,
which I love.
Yeah.
with port, vodka, cinnamon, cardamom, anise, cloves, and ginger. Mm. And then he simmers it with orange hunks and pours it into glasses that already have a spoonful of raisins and almonds.
Oh, my goodness.
If there's ever a cold day in Miami, that ought to warm you up.
Now, this wine is what we drink. It starts our holiday season in Sweden. It's called glögg, and it starts around December 1. And it's just, you hold it like this, and you sip it. And
people can't see something.
No, you hold it.
He's holding it, and he's sipping it. He's showing
and your
his
hands
mouth.
Are cold, but that's what I mean. And after you've been out skiing or walking on the ice, things like in Miami that you don't do that often. But it's wonderful spiced wine. Does not work in the heat, but it's a wonderful spiced wine that you just get in the mood for the holidays for.
Well, in Miami, what we do sometimes is turn the AC all the way down and then light a fireplace fire and have some glögg.
That would be perfect. Great.
All right.
Anyway, that's it for the world of wine. Yeah.
Thank you, Fred. Well, let's talk about your connection to Ethiopia, because you left it at 3 years old, but I understand you went back and found your family.
Yeah, my sister always said to me, Marcus, you know, you have to go back and find. We have to go back and find our father. I think he still might be alive. So we connected with an adoption agency, and it took about 4 years, and eventually we found our father.
Because originally you were told that he had died.
Yes, he has passed away.
Yes.
And, you know, adoption is a very complex issue, and it's always sort of, it's one side that loses somebody or gives somebody up, and another side of that.
You still always had that urge to
You do. You ask questions. And my Swedish parents always said, hey, find out more about Ethiopia, find out more about your family. And we were more like Swedish teenagers, just like, no, we just want to be Swedish, leave us alone. But eventually when you go into your 20s, you want to find out more about yourself. So I found my father, and then I found out that I had 8 other sisters and brothers. So now
so
I see
half, my, there were half sisters
yes,
and brothers.
Yes, and now I see them every year. And I put, you know, the kids are now in school and college, some of them, and it's a wonderful addition to my life. And
what does your sister do?
My sister lives in Sweden, and she has a family. She's married. She has kids. And I have 2 sisters in Sweden, and they're both, you know, working just regular Swedish families, in like the middle class.
Nothing culinary.
Nothing. They cook a lot for their families, and that's it.
So the other sister was a member of the Swedish family.
She was also adopted.
She was also adopted.
Yeah, and that's the thing in adoption, right? Like the fact that my parents couldn't have their own kids was also the biggest fortune for us.
Right.
So there's so many things in life that is sort of random luck that just happens, and I think that's what I talk about in Yes, Chef a lot.
It's fascinating, fascinating book. And it reads very well. I mean,
Thank you.
Couldn't put it down. It
took 5 years to do. How about that?
Oh, my goodness. Oh, my goodness. One other point I noticed, when I was at the Fancy Food Show, I saw a tea. And the tea was your
Ambessa tea, yeah.
Tell us about that.
Well, you know, tea, Ambessa means lion in Amharic, in Ethiopia. And tea is always a ritual, I think, that, you know, people of hundreds of generations have always celebrated, got together, break bread over tea. And it's a classy, something that you can just, you know, when you go to a British afternoon tea party versus there's been a big dinner, you just cleanse with tea. So I want to celebrate African teas.
And there's different, apparently there are different flavored teas
absolutely.
According to the different countries you've lived
in. Yes, absolutely. So it's a sort of follows the journey, that lingonberry green tea and so on.
Well, I was so surprised to see it there and all. So that's very, very interesting. It's been a very, very tasty week. And Chef Marcus Samuelsson, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you guys for having me. Thank
you.
What's next up for your projects?
Well, you know, the going back to Harlem and keep cooking in Harlem is going to take a lot of my time. So.
Do you have other restaurants there?
Not in Harlem, but we have other restaurants. But Red Rooster is really where I work out.
Now, if I come to Harlem, you'll take care of me?
I'll definitely take
care of you.
I'll
ask for you.
Yes. Okay. Bring the picture with the First Lady.
People should know that she...
I had some old pictures, and I was there with Rosalind Carter, who had been on the program.
Yeah,
right.
And Chef Samuelsson saw it.
So. All right. So his book is Yes, Chef, A Memoir. And it really is a very fascinating read. Fred Tasker, great advice as always.
Always a pleasure.
And Joe Cooper, you ate well today.
I certainly did. That dinner in minutes is right on.
Okay, where can we find it?
dinnerinminutes.com.
Oh, I didn't know that.
What a pawn I am.
I'm Linda
Gass. What a shill.
Thank you. I'm Linda Gassenheimer. Join me next week for more food news and views.
And that wraps up today's edition. Our producer is Richard Ive. Technical direction by Caroline Brader-Watts and Bonnie Berman. Paul Leary gives production assistance. Follow us at the Topical Currents Facebook page. Find author and book links there. Also, we have free audio archives and MP3 downloads at our website. That's WLRN.org. And tomorrow at 1, it's Ed Bell and the South Florida Arts Beat. Monday is Labor Day, so Tuesday we return with a program about the inherent flaws in the criminal justice system. And the calendar on this day in 30 B.C., 2,042 years ago, the suicide of Egyptian Queen Cleopatra, allegedly by the bite of an asp. Cleopatra was actually Macedonian. Also on this day in 1893, 119 years ago, the birth of Louisiana Governor and Senator Huey Long. He gained fame for a lawsuit against Standard Oil for unfair business practice. While a U.S. Senator, he was assassinated in September of 1935. 200,000 people attended his funeral in Baton Rouge. The Kingfish. And one more while we ponder the old professor. On this day in 1965, 47 years ago, Casey Stengel retires after a 55-year career in baseball. He's the only man to wear the uniform of all four New York Major League teams. Our theme music created by Michael Levine. We leave with a thought from Casey Stengel, number 37, who won 7 World Series with the Yankees. This upon his dismissal in 1960. Quote, "I was fired for turning 70. I'll never make that mistake again." This is Joseph Cooper. Thanks for making Public Radio your companion today. Stay tuned now for the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.